stress response.
So children need challenges to build resilience, but the stress of the challenges has to be just right, and the scaffolding of support has to be in place, or the child can get dysregulated and fail, in which case, rather than building confidence and resilience, you risk eroding self-esteem, or worse.
That's right. You need moderate activation of your stress response. You can't become a good athlete unless you stress and challenge your cardiovascular system and your muscles, but you have to do it in a way that's predictable and moderate. Otherwise, you risk injury.
And you can't become a healthy human being unless you've had some challenges that allow you to build resilience and empathy.
Exactly. Healthy development involves a series of challenges and exposure to new things. And failure is an important part of the process. We try, we fall, we get up, we try again and again. All developmental success comes after failure. And typically many failures will occur before mastery is achieved. The key is to have challenges that are achievable, close enough to your current capabilities that you will succeed with some encouragement, practice, and repetition. A child in an environment where they feel loved and safe will choose to leave their comfort zone. Safe and familiar is boring. A safe and stable child is a curious child. They want to explore new things. A child who feels unsafe, however, won't want this. It's an essential rule of healthy development. A sense of safety and stability provides a foundation for healthy growth.
The process you're describing will be very different if the child is in a home where there's been nothing but chaos or a lack of dependability. I'm thinking of all the people we encounter who are ready to fight the minute you say anything they feel is critical or confrontational, the slightest thing, and they're ready to blow.
Yes. This might be someone with a sensitized stress response system. Our brain processes incoming sensory input from the bottom up, and if someone has a life with chaotic, uncontrollable, or extreme and prolonged stress, particularly early in life, they're more likely to act before thinking. Their cortex is not as active, and reactivity in the lower parts of the brain becomes more dominant. It's very difficult to meaningfully connect with or get through to someone who's not regulated. And it's nearly impossible to reason with them. This is why telling someone who's dysregulated to calm down never works.
It just makes them angrier.
Absolutely. When someone is very upset, words themselves are not very effective. The tone and rhythm of the voice probably has more impact than the actual words.
So you want to be present with them.
Exactly. It's best if you can simply be present. If you do use words, it's best to restate what they're saying. This is called reflective listening. You can't talk someone out of feeling angry, sad, or frustrated, but you can be a sponge and absorb their emotional intensity. If you stay regulated, ultimately, they will catch your calm. It also helps to use some form of rhythmic regulating activity to keep yourself regulated while you're doing this. Like taking a walk, kicking a ball back and forth, shooting some baskets, coloring side by side. There are dozens of rhythmic ways to help us regulate.
Because doing things with movement and rhythm offers a more connected way of communicating.
Absolutely. As we discussed, rhythm is so important, and it's often overlooked as a therapeutic tool. I remember a time I was listening to Mike Roseman, the Korean War veteran we met in Chapter 1. He was talking about his weekend. I say listening, but in fact I was partially listening, partially mind-wandering. I felt like I'd heard the same thing a dozen times. I slept like a baby on Saturday night, slept all night long, felt really good on Sunday. Then I had a terrible night again last night. Then something clicked. I had heard this a dozen times. Every Monday, Mike said the same thing about Saturday night. I looked at him sheepishly. What did you say you did this weekend? He said, we went to dinner and then to a dance club. And what do you do at the dance club? He looked at me and raised his eyebrows. Oh, you dance, right? But how much? Do you dance for hours or just for one or two songs, waltz, hip-hop? They play all kinds of music, but mostly it's swing. a little rock and roll sometimes. I pretty much dance on and off for 3 hours. And last week you told me you fell asleep at physical therapy when they gave you a massage at the end of the session, right? Yes. Thinking about this helped me begin to piece together the regulating potential of patterned repetitive activity, like dancing or massage. As you recall, Mike Roseman had PTSD. His stress response system, including his core regulatory networks, was overactive and overly reactive. That made it hard for him to fall asleep. And when he did, his sensitized stress response system made it hard to transition smoothly through the various stages of sleep. As a result, he was a very light sleeper, typically waking after a few hours. Many nights he would doze for only a few minutes before startling awake at the slightest noise. He was always exhausted. But now he was telling me that he had a long, deep, refreshing sleep after hours of dancing, and that he fell asleep in minutes when he was getting a massage. From that point forward, a major component of Mike's therapy was physical therapy. Several times a week, he would get massages for his bad back. I encouraged him to dance in smaller doses all week long and to walk. He started walking all over town. A month or so after creating a more structured schedule of rhythmic activities, he began sleeping much better, and his other post-traumatic symptoms started to be less intrusive.
It's incredible that something as simple as walking can have that effect. Walking is very regulating for me.
And it's especially regulating if you can walk in nature. The sensory elements of the natural world bathe us with their own regulating rhythms. Let's keep talking about how you can help a dysregulated person feel more regulated. Instead of saying, hey, tell me what you're thinking about, you need to let them control when and how much they're going to talk about what's upsetting them. If you give a person that control and help them feel safe, in their own time, they will be more capable of talking.
Yes. I remember the first time I interviewed Elizabeth Smart's parents. You may recall that Elizabeth was taken at knife point from her home in Salt Lake City at the age of 14 and was held captive for more than 9 months. And when I interviewed her parents after she was recovered, I asked, what has she said about it? What have you talked about? And they told me she hadn't said anything yet.
So you didn't ask?
We didn't ask. Elizabeth went through a lot telling her story to forensic psychologists, and that was enough. And she said, you can tell my dad or you can tell my parents.
And so you think you
we heard enough.
You know what happened.
I know what happened. I heard enough. And I wanted her to know that she was home, that she was safe, and that she did not have to bother with this the rest of her life, that it was time for her to move on. And she has moved on.
At the time, I was surprised, but I now understand that they were waiting for her in her own time, in her own way, because as you're saying, if you control when and how much a traumatized person talks, it can be re-traumatizing rather than healing.
Exactly. We want to provide therapeutic healing interactions, moderate, controllable, and predictable interactions. Remember the way you described talking with Gail? And the little boy who told the checkout clerk that his mother was dead? Controlling when, how much, and which aspect of a traumatic event they share allows a person to create their own therapeutic pattern of recovery. No one knows what a moderate dose of revisiting a trauma memory is better than the actual traumatized person. For the little boy in the grocery store, it was literally only seconds long. We've talked a lot about patterns of stress activation that create sensitization, which is essentially the opposite of resilience. But when we activate trauma memories and our stress response systems in ways that offer controllability and predictability, we can begin to heal a sensitized system. Healing takes place when there are dozens of therapeutic moments available each day for the person to control revisiting and reworking their traumatic experience. When you have friends, family, and other healthy people in your life, you have a natural healing environment. We heal best in community. Creating a network, a village, whatever you want to call it, gives you opportunities to revisit trauma in moderate, controllable doses. that pattern of stress activation will ultimately lead to a more regulated stress reactivity curve. So the traumatized person with a sensitized stress response can become neurotypical, less sensitized, less vulnerable. In fact, they can ultimately develop the capacity to demonstrate resilience. The journey from traumatized to typical to resilient helps create a unique strength and perspective. That journey can create post-traumatic wisdom. For thousands and thousands of years, humans lived in small intergenerational groups. There were no mental health clinics, but there was plenty of trauma. I assume that many of our ancestors experienced post-traumatic problems, anxiety, depression, sleep disruptions. But I also assume that they experienced healing. Our species could not have survived if a majority of our traumatized ancestors lost their capacity to function well. The pillars of traditional healing were, number one, connection to clan and the natural world. Number two, regulating rhythm through dance, drumming, and song. Number three, a set of beliefs, values, and stories that brought meaning to even senseless random trauma. And four, on occasion, natural hallucinogens or other plant-derived substances used to facilitate healing with the guidance of a healer or elder. It is not surprising that today's best practices in trauma treatment are basically versions of these four things. Unfortunately, few modern approaches use all four of the options well. The medical model overfocuses on psychopharmacology, option four, and cognitive behavioral approaches, option three. It greatly undervalues the power of connectedness, option one, and rhythm, option two. I once worked with a four-year-old girl named Allie. She had witnessed the death of her mother at the hands of her father, who then committed suicide. Allie lived in a very close-knit community, and after the traumatic loss of her parents, she moved in with one of her aunts. There were easily 30 cousins, aunts, uncles, and grandparents living in the community, and they were always together for birthdays, holidays, family events. Allie was an active member of her church, played sports, and had a very supportive elementary school with trauma-sensitive teachers. Part of our work with her was educating the adults in her life, including her teachers, about trauma. In the first weeks after Allie was found, we saw her about three times a week. Within a month, it was down to once a week. After the first year anniversary, we needed to see her only once a month. 6 months later, we told her aunt to simply reach out if there were any questions or problems. The last I heard about Allie was that she'd been elected class president at her middle school, was active in sports and her church, and was doing very well in school. She and her aunt reported no significant symptoms. Of course, there was sadness on occasions, but Allie was a positive, happy, engaging girl. The scars remained, but she was weathering well. And she was a wise soul. She had developed post-traumatic wisdom.
Post-traumatic wisdom. I love that. Allie's experience has a positive outcome, so isn't that an example of a child being resilient?
Absolutely. But not because she was born resilient. Allie was able to show resilience in the face of tragedy due to the quality of loving relationships earlier in her life. Resilience is a capability that can wax and wane, not a permanent innate trait. If Allie hadn't had a safe, stable, and nurturing family, an understanding teacher, or her strong faith, her ability to bounce back would have been quickly drained away. Her ability to heal and continue to demonstrate resilience was related to ongoing safe and stable relationships through which she could make sense of horror and put it in the context of her beliefs. Even the most seemingly resilient people can be drained by relational poverty and ongoing stress, distress, and trauma.
Allie's story and the way you describe the healing power of the intergenerational clans from thousands of years ago makes me think of growing up in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, and how the church was the central point of our life. Every week I'd be there for Sunday school, followed by 11 o'clock service. We'd go home. My grandmother would cook before we returned for another service at 3 o'clock, and then Baptist Training Union at 5 or 6. On Wednesday nights, we'd go for a prayer service and choir rehearsal. At 3.5 years old, I was speaking in front of the congregation. The hours I spent in that little white church by the red dirt road certainly formed the spiritual foundation for my life. Later, when I was living in Nashville with my father, I accepted a job as a reporter at a television station in Baltimore. As I was preparing to leave my family and the life I knew, my father's advice to me was, find a church home. At the time, I thought it was because he wanted to make sure I kept Jesus in my life. Looking back now, though, as we talk about the healing power relationships, I realize it wasn't just about finding a place of worship. It was about finding a community and discovering true, lasting connection in a new city. In those days, church was everything. Your counselor, your nurturer, your comforter, your refuge. The idea of going to therapy wasn't even discussed. If you needed help, you went to church. As I said, we weathered together. It was your church family that made sure you had a place to go for Sunday dinner. They were the ones who visited you when you were sick or passed around the collection plate if you couldn't put food on the table. The church was even where we created that healing sense of rhythm. Our music connected and lifted us. For many people, church isn't their thing, but everyone needs people who can listen, be present, make them feel heard and seen. And as we're talking, I see that a key to healing from trauma is finding your church home, your people, your community. This can help build resilience, post-traumatic healing, and ultimately post-traumatic wisdom, as you say. It can help you become wise.
It is impossible to be truly wise without some real-life hardship. And we cannot develop post-traumatic wisdom without weathering. And, most importantly, as you point out, weathering together.
Social connection builds resilience, and resilience helps create post-traumatic wisdom, and that wisdom leads to hope. Hope for you and hope for others witnessing and participating in your healing. Hope for your community.
Absolutely. A healthy community is a healing community, and a healing community is full of hope because it has seen its own people weather, survive, and thrive. The first time I saw how a healing community can work was almost 30 years ago. This experience completely shifted the way I think about therapeutics. I started to understand that most therapeutic experience, most healing, happens outside of formal therapy. Most healing happens in community. In February of 1993, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF, attempted a raid on David Koresh's Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas. 4 ATF members and 6 Davidians were killed in the raid. Over the next 3 days, the FBI negotiated the release of 21 of the children in the compound. Then these releases stopped, and a 51-day siege ensued. It ended with an FBI assault that precipitated a Davidian-lit fire, which killed 76 Davidians, including the remaining 25 children. Several days after the initial ATF raid, I was asked by officials of the state of Texas to lead a clinical team to care for the released Davidian children. They were all housed in a single large cottage on the Methodist Home campus in Waco. They ranged in age from 3 to 13, a mix of boys and girls. They had been in an hours-long firefight and had seen members of their community die. Each of them had been separated from family and handed over to complete strangers, usually armed FBI agents in SWAT gear. In the days before we took over, the children experienced chaos. Each day was unpredictable, and each child interacted with dozens of strange people, some of them armed. While growing up, the children had been indoctrinated to believe that all non-Davidians were Babylonians, intent on destroying David Koresh and all of his followers. So here were these children, torn away from everything they knew, being cared for by people they believed would kill them. Bottom line, this was a group of acutely traumatized children. In the first days we worked with them, the children exhibited various acute post-traumatic effects, For example, as a group, the average resting heart rate was 132, whereas normal would have been less than 90. There was some pressure to do therapy with these children. But I knew that talking with dysregulated children was not going to be effective. I felt our first task should be to bring structure and predictability to their day. We started to make the uncontrollable and unpredictable more controllable and predictable. I limited unnecessary access to the children, no more new adults. We had group meetings in the morning to outline the day and in the evening to review the day. At the meetings, the children had opportunities to ask questions. We had play, quiet time, and meals, always at the same time. And we gave the children multiple opportunities to make choices about what they ate, what they played with, how they spent their quiet time. Each day after the children went to bed, our team would meet. We would talk about each child, and any member of the team who'd had any interaction with that child was asked to describe it. I logged these brief interactions on a spreadsheet, hour by hour. Many were brief therapeutic moments. A child would ask, "What do you think will happen to my mom?" Then listen to a reassuring comment and drift back to play. The children were controlling when and how they talked about the traumatic events they had experienced. They were also seeking safe, stable, and physically regulating interactions. Push me on the swing. Let's draw. As I added up the interactions, I saw that despite no formal therapy sessions, the children were getting over 2 hours of therapeutic interaction each day. By the end of 3 weeks with our team, the children were much more regulated. The group heart rate had dropped below 100 into the normal range. They were more interactive and talkative, and the therapeutic interactions became more verbal. One of the most important observations was that these children needed different kinds of therapeutic interaction at different times. They knew this even better than we did. A child who wanted quiet, nurturing interactions would seek out one of our staff who was a really good listener and able to sit quietly without talking. Not easy for most adults. When this same child wanted to play, they'd seek out a member of our team who was younger and more playful. When they wanted reassurance from an authority figure, they'd come to me. Each of us had a unique set of personality characteristics, and at any given moment, our particular strength might be just what one of the children needed. No one person, no single therapist, could be all things for all the children who were each at different stages of development and in different states of regulation. Our clinical structure at Waco reminded me of the importance of developmental diversity for children. Think of the diversity within a small, multifamily, multigenerational clan. Children growing up had numerous adults and older children who could model, teach, nurture, discipline, and care for them. Each person in the clan had a unique set of strengths. The right person at the right time. No single person was expected to provide all the emotional, social, physical, or cognitive needs of the developing child. This is incredibly unlike our modern world. We expect a single working mother to be the one to throw the baseball with her 8-year-old, rock the newborn, read to the 3-year-old, and, by the way, cook a nutritious meal, help with the homework, do the laundry, get everyone to bed, then wake up and get them all ready for childcare and school so she can go work all day, only to rush home and do it all again, all alone.
She needs people to step up, people who support her, give her some breaks, step in, do some of those things with her children. We're not meant to be isolated and alone. We're actually meant to work together. So when a single mom is living on a limited income, trying to manage 4 children, trying to be mother and father, and she feels overwhelmed or feels like it's impossible to do it all, it's because it is impossible to do it all.
It's such an unfair expectation of our society. No other society in the history of this planet has ever asked a single adult to provide the physical, social, emotional, and material needs of multiple children by themselves.
You're not meant to raise children isolated and alone.
Absolutely not. We are meant to distribute caregiving among the many adults in our band, our community. In a typical hunter-gatherer clan, for every child under six, there were four developmentally more mature individuals who could model, discipline, nurture, and instruct the child. That is a 4-to-1 ratio. Four developmentally mature individuals for each child under six. We now think that one caregiver for four young children, a ratio of 1-to-4, is enriched. That is 1/16th of what our developing social brain is looking for. That is relational poverty.
It makes me want to weep for all the single parents out there who are doing it every day and breaking their backs and their spirits and not even able to take care of themselves. It also makes me think of my mother differently. She did the best she could and was often too tired to do any better.
And single parents, like your mother, often end up feeling like they're inadequate, that there's something wrong with them, that they aren't enough. When really, it's the modern world that's not enough. A strong connection to community is as important today as it was thousands of years ago. The tragedy of the modern world is that community like this is harder and harder to find. Not everybody has friends like Gail. Fewer people are active in their community of faith. Not everybody feels like they belong. There is a direct relationship between a person's degree of social isolation and their risk for physical and mental health problems. But when you do have connectedness, your church home, you have built-in buffers for whatever stress or distress you experience.
We do belong. We are enough, but it's hard to see that in our current world.
Exactly. Imagine that your annual review at work goes badly. Your supervisor gives you some negative feedback. You feel really upset. You keep thinking about it. You run it through your head again and again. You go back and talk to one of your colleagues. Can you believe he said that? I don't think that's true. And your colleague listens and reassures you, no, that's not true. He's full of it. You feel soothed for a bit. Then you call another colleague and run it by her. And you go home and you go over it with your partner. You've engaged in 3, 4, 5 doses where you controlled how and when you talked about the distressing feedback. As your perspective is heard, you become regulated, reassured. The next day you feel better. You have created a controllable and moderate revisiting of the distressing review, and that has changed your reaction to it. It is no longer as distressing. Originally, you were dysregulated. You shut down the rational part of your head, distorted the comments, magnified them. But now you can reflect more accurately on the feedback and maybe see some truth in the comments. That wasn't possible until you could use your many relational interactions to revisit and regulate. When we have a community, we can do this kind of dosing to regulate any stressful or distressing experience. We can build and demonstrate resilience. We do so all the time. But imagine someone without the relationships that would allow this kind of relational regulation. For someone with relational poverty, these stressful experiences are magnified by the echo chamber of their own head. Stress becomes distress, and distressing experiences become sensitizing, resulting in the same physical and mental effects as trauma. This is the challenge for our modern world. How can we create community when we are so mobile, so screened up, so disconnected? It's a major challenge for creating a healthy future. How can we ensure connectedness and a sense of safety and belonging for everyone?
Chapter 8, Our Brains, Our Biases, Our Systems. In 2015, I interviewed a man named Shaka Senghor for my show Super Soul Sunday. At the age of 19, Shaka had been convicted of second-degree murder. He served 19 years in prison, including a total of 7 years in solitary confinement. At the beginning of his sentence, Shaka was angry and violent, and quickly sank into a system that had no interest in preparing him for his eventual return to the outside world. But after 6 years behind bars, something shifted, and Shaka began to transform. In his 5x7 cell, he started meditating, reading, journaling, and writing what would eventually become his best-selling memoir, Righting My Wrongs. When I first saw a photo of Shaka on the cover of his book, I was skeptical. What could this tattooed, dreadlocked, convicted killer teach me? I thought. Our conversation was one of the best I've ever experienced. As his story unfolded over the course of our 2.5 hours together, so did my understanding of what it means to fall short, what it means to go astray, what it truly means to be shaped by your environment. Shaka, born James White, grew up in a middle-class family in Detroit. His father, a member of the Air Force Reserves, worked for the state of Michigan. His mother stayed at home with James and his 5 siblings. As a young boy, James was a straight-A student with dreams of becoming a doctor. From the outside, the Whites looked like the ideal American family. But Shaka says, for as long as he can remember, his mother had an explosive temper and took out her rage on her children.
So, let me ask you this. Did you feel loved growing up?
I didn't feel like I was told, you know, I do this because I love you. But it was always a whooping or a punishment.
Yeah. I mean, Shaka, yeah. I mean, I grew up like that too. Where, I mean, if I were asked that question, yeah. I would say no, I didn't feel loved growing up.
Shaka recalled coming home from school one day when he was 9 years old, thrilled to have gotten an A+ on a test, and hoping his mother would share his joy. Instead, she threw a pot at him so furiously it cracked the tiles on the kitchen wall behind him. I asked if he ever found out what she was upset about. I never knew, he said. My mother was upset often. As I listened, my heart broke for Shaka and the millions of people who, as children, regularly experienced paralyzing fear at home. The tragedy isn't just what that fear felt like in the moment. It's that they learned to bury the emotion and accept the behavior. In addition to his mother's physical abuse, Shaka says the last 5 years of his parents' marriage were unstable. He was devastated by their separations and rejoiced at their reunions, gutted and lifted each time the cycle repeated. When they finally divorced, Shaka, tired of being betrayed by the people he loved most, says he built an emotional wall and sought protection and acceptance from the streets. He began acting out, getting in fights, refusing to do schoolwork, running away from home. What struck me most about Shaka's story is that at no time during this change from straight-A student to street kid did anyone ask, "What happened to you? Why are you behaving this way?" Not one adult seemed to notice or care that this young boy had completely lost his way. By age 14, Shaka was selling drugs, breaking into houses, and shoplifting. After being shot at 17, he began carrying a gun with him at all times. He was in a culture and environment that perpetuated the idea that a young man's worth was defined by having money, attention, and a reputation as the bad guy.
Because in that space, I felt accepted. So leaving home, and I was around other broken, fragile young males, that we banded together around our brokenness. And we just like, this is support. This is love. This is I got your back no matter what.
But weren't you the smart one who wanted to be a doctor, I asked? Why did you want to be a doctor? He paused for 23 seconds, an eternity in TV time. I could tell he'd never really thought about this before.
That's all I've ever wanted to do, like, growing up. Like, that was, and I think back to, like, why was that what I wanted to do? And I realized that I like nice people. Mm-hmm. And the doctor was always nice to me. Mm-hmm. And even when my mother would take me to the doctor, she was nice. And like, I'm like, if I'm a doctor, it should be nice, you know? And so that, wow.
You just had an aha there.
Yeah.
It was a deeply moving moment of realization for both of us. A young man, confused and rejected by those who were charged with raising him, simply seeking his mother's validation and love. When he was 19, Shaka's dangerous life choices came to a head. One night, on his way home from a party, he started arguing with a man named David. In the middle of the fight, Shaka grabbed his gun and pulled the trigger and shot David, dead. In prison, Shaka found an environment he was familiar with, one where violence and domination reigned. He repeatedly landed himself in solitary confinement for everything from assaulting prison guards to trying to escape. What finally broke him open was a letter from his son. "Dear Dad," the letter read, "my mother told me you was in prison for murder. Dear Dad, don't murder anymore. Jesus watches what you do. Pray to him and he'll forgive your sins."
That was the awakening.
It was your born again moment.
Yeah. That was the moment when I decided that I would never go back to the darkness and that I had to find my light and that I owed it to him to find my light.
Since Shaka's release from prison in 2010, he's been a vocal advocate for criminal justice reform. He speaks to young people across the country, sharing his story and encouraging young men to avoid life on the streets. He's taught classes at the University of Michigan and is a fellow of the MIT Media Lab. At the heart of his work is the belief that people should not be defined by their past mistakes and that redemption is possible. Most people who are in the process of excavating the reasons they do what they do are met at some point with resistance. You're blaming the past. Your past is not an excuse. This is true. Your past is not an excuse, but it is an explanation, offering insight into the questions so many of us ask ourselves. Why do I behave the way I behave? Why do I feel the way I do? For me, there is no doubt that our strengths, vulnerabilities, and unique responses are an expression of what happened to us. Very often, what happened takes years to reveal itself. It takes courage to confront our actions, peel back the layers of trauma in our lives, and expose the raw truth of our past. But this is where healing begins. Oprah. When we first started talking about trauma over 30 years ago, not many people were aware of its impact on so many aspects of life. Have things changed? When you look at schools, the healthcare system, the criminal justice system, really everywhere you look, there are people impacted by trauma who are still misunderstood and sometimes re-traumatized by the very systems that should be helping them.
That is the heartbreaking truth. It takes a long time to change people and even longer to change systems. I am optimistic, though. Many positive changes are underway. Many more people are aware of how pervasive trauma is. More people understand that trauma can influence our health. But we do have a long way to go. We need more professionals and organizations to change the way they do business to help address the impact of trauma.
You're talking about trauma-informed care.
Yes and no. As you know, I'm not a fan of that term. I'm impressed by what is happening in many places attempting to implement trauma-informed care, but I think the language is getting in the way of progress. Let me explain why. As we've been discussing, the complexities of trauma impact all of our systems, from maternal child health to child welfare to education, law enforcement, mental health, and more. Each of these systems is a world unto itself, with its own professionals, its own attitudes, its own language. We've talked about how individual people develop their unique worldview. Well, the same thing happens with systems and organizations. They develop a dominant perspective. In the past, most of these perspectives have not included any significant understanding of development, stress, or trauma, or interrelated issues that can cause distress or trauma, such as implicit bias, racism, and misogyny. But with so much new research emerging about these areas and these issues, it's become clear that our systems can't ignore them. And as each system has grappled with what trauma-informed means, they've used their own particular lens, their own view of the world. The result is that defining the term has been a challenge. Like the word trauma, it's been used by many different people and groups in many different ways. It may take some time to sort this out. The term trauma-informed care, or TIC, emerged back in 2001 to encourage mental health and child welfare systems to recognize that trauma was an important but misunderstood factor in the lives of the people these systems were serving. Over time, many groups started to use the term with minimal definition or clarity. Organizations would have a 3-hour seminar and declare themselves trauma-informed. Cities gave themselves the label. Even countries aspired to become the first trauma-informed nation. All of this was confusing. What constitutes a trauma-informed city anyway? Buzzwords abounded, but they were rarely connected to concrete implementation plans or changes in services, programs, or policy. TIC training became a cottage industry with hundreds of organizations and self-declared experts willing to take your money to ensure that you and your organization were, quote, trauma-informed. The quality of this training was, as you might expect, highly inconsistent. In response to this chaotic beginning, scores of countries, states, professional organizations, interdisciplinary committees, and professional teams worked to define and implement TIC. Unfortunately, these disjointed efforts further complicated things. As one committee concluded, despite years of work in the field, there is not a common definition of TIC. Dozens of versions of the crucial elements, principles, pillars, ingredients, assumptions, components, domains, and guidelines of trauma-informed care have emerged. But while there are some consistent concepts, the variability is head-spinning. The result is that you never know which version of trauma-informed care someone is thinking of when they use the term. This is why, when I'm talking about trauma practice, programs, or policy, I always try to describe the specific concepts, content, or objective, rather than use the term TIC or trauma-informed care. Having said all of this, I do think that these efforts are really important and that progress is being made. All of these organizations are teaching about trauma, advocating for increased public awareness and supporting research to learn more. Many are evaluating and promoting promising interventions. In 1989, the National Center for PTSD was formed within the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, to study trauma and support veterans impacted by mostly combat-related trauma. In 2000, the National Center for Child Traumatic Stress was formed. It wasn't until 2018 that the branches of the CDC and SAMHSA dedicated to studying trauma came up with their 7 principles of trauma-informed care, which I suspect will continue to evolve as the field grows up. It's easy to forget how young traumatology, the study of trauma, is. And developmental traumatology as a discipline is even younger. Right now, organizations and systems are just starting to grapple with the very issues we've been discussing in this audiobook. And grapple they must, because trauma permeates all aspects of life. It echoes through the generations, across families, communities, institutions, cultures, and societies. And it does so in very complex ways. Trauma can impact our genes, white blood cells, heart, gut, lungs, and brain, our thinking, feeling, behaving, parenting, teaching, coaching, consuming, creating, prescribing, arresting, sentencing. I could go on. So depending upon your perspective, your worldview, and your own history of trauma and loss, you will have some unique version of trauma-informed.
But in essence, it's approaching people with the awareness that what happened to you is important, that it influences your behavior and your health, and then using that awareness to act accordingly and respond appropriately, whether you're a parent, a teacher, a friend, therapist, doctor, police officer, judge.
Yes, that captures, as well as any other brief statement, the essence of trauma-informed. The act accordingly part is so important. It's one thing to be aware that trauma can result in certain behaviors and problems. It's another thing to ask, what do we do now? How do we create opportunities for healing within our system? How can we avoid repeating unpredictable, uncontrollable stressors that will exacerbate the effects of trauma? How do we make sure we don't re-traumatize someone by unintentionally continuing the marginalizing, dehumanizing experiences that gave rise to the very problems we're supposed to be addressing? I believe that if you don't recognize the built-in biases in yourself and the structural biases in your systems, biases regarding race, gender, sexual orientation, you can't truly be trauma-informed. Marginalized peoples, excluded, minimized, shamed, are traumatized peoples. Because as we've discussed, humans are fundamentally relational creatures. To be excluded or dehumanized in an organization, community, or society you are part of results in prolonged, uncontrollable stress that is sensitizing. Marginalization is a fundamental trauma. This is why I believe that a truly trauma-informed system is an anti-racist system. The destructive effects of racial marginalization are pervasive and severe. In North America, Australia, and New Zealand, for instance, Black, brown, and indigenous children are more likely to be overdiagnosed and overmedicated in mental health systems, removed from their homes to enter the child welfare system, suspended or expelled from school, and charged at school with truancy and assault, with the result that they enter the juvenile justice system in disproportionate ways. As we've talked about, a child with traumatic experiences will often have difficulty learning and also be overreactive to the feedback and criticisms that come with struggling in school. This can lead to behavior problems. The behaviors are often misunderstood. So many of the things that people and systems do with good intentions actually cause additional pain for the families and children they're supposed to be serving.
This is something I want to discuss in a deeper way. During our 60 Minutes conversation, I realized that so many of the charities and nonprofits out there trying to fix social problems today are really only addressing the surface. They're attempting to build the community scaffolding we know is important, but many are missing the causes, the foundations of the problems they're trying to solve. If an after-school program doesn't understand why a child is experiencing chronic health problems or having trouble keeping up in school, if an employment program doesn't figure out why someone is having a hard time with supervisors or always explodes at people, then these programs will not succeed in creating lasting change. So walk us through how some of these issues actually develop and present themselves.
Well, let's start with young children. We've talked repeatedly about the important role of early life relationships in the development of the stress response systems and the capacity to form future healthy relationships. We know that when children experience distress and trauma, including poverty, homelessness, domestic violence, maltreatment, they will have some disruptions in development. Frequently, the result is a splintering of the maturation of specific skills, as we've talked about in Chapter 6, in relation to neglect. So a 5-year-old may have only developed the language skills of a typical 2-year-old and the self-regulation capabilities of a typical 4-year-old. Along with this fragmented development, the child will have an overactive and overly reactive stress response. Now envision this child entering a preschool environment with expectations, transitions, rules, and curricula designed for the typical five-year-old. A developmentally uninformed, trauma-unaware setting will expect this child to act typical. But that is impossible for this child. The day will be filled with communication difficulties due to their language development and intense frustration due to their self-regulation capabilities. In this overwhelmingly distressing situation, they will shut down or blow up. Either way, they don't get the full benefit of the social, emotional, or academic learning. They fall further behind. They may be kicked out. More children are expelled from school in pre-K than at any other grade level. Children of color, especially boys of color, are expelled at rates 3 times higher than white children. This is the start of a toxic mismatch between the child's capabilities and the unrealistic expectations of an education system that is all too often under-resourced, developmentally uninformed, and trauma-ignorant. Even if the child progresses to the next grade, they're still behind, and this sets them up to fail. Year after year, they fall further and further behind. Their delays in developing skills, together with their trauma-related symptoms, begin to attract mental health labels. The hypervigilance from their sensitized stress response is labeled ADHD. Their predictable efforts to self-regulate by rocking, chewing gum, doodling, daydreaming, listening to music, tapping their pencil, that's all prohibited. They will be labeled, medicated, excluded, punished, perhaps expelled, and then, all too often, arrested. When they try to avoid the constant humiliation of school, they're charged with truancy. When they try to flee and the school staff tries to stop them, a restraint incident results in charges of assault against the child. This is the school-to-prison pipeline.
And add to all this the fact that the student most likely has no idea that there is an underlying cause for their struggles. They end up adopting the world's view of them. They're dumb, slow, or lazy. It's a cycle of failure that chips away at their self-esteem until the student becomes so frustrated or ashamed that they give up.
This is such an important point. A child who is struggling is not going to say, "This poor teacher simply doesn't understand state-dependent functioning and the impact of trauma on my ability to learn. She should be helping me regulate, not conjugate." They say, "I must be dumb." The other really important point about schools is how many children and youth are experiencing learning and behavioral challenges related to trauma. This isn't just a few children. Studies show that between 30 and 50% of children in public schools have 3 or more adverse childhood experiences. And as we've discussed, these adversities have an impact. Imagine how many children are sitting in school with trauma-related memories that can be activated by innocent cues in the classroom. Remember that what we experience in the present moment is filtered by the lower parts of our brain before getting to the cortex. All incoming sensory information from the present moment is compared to and influenced by the memories of previous experiences and is first processed in the lower, more reactive areas of the brain before reaching the rational thinking areas. Let's say an older child has grown up with episodic domestic violence. When he was younger, he saw his father belittling and hitting his mother. This happened at an important period of brain development when he was making primary memories to make sense of his world. His brain comes to associate attributes of men with threat. A loud, low, masculine voice is connected with fear. 5 years after these associations and memories were made, this young student has a male English teacher who happens to look a little like his abusive father. About the same height, same hair color, deep voice. The boy is not capable of consciously making the connection, but simply sitting in the classroom gives him a feeling of discomfort. This originates in those precortical lower parts of the brain. It's subconscious. Remember Sam, the boy whose father wore Old Spice? A person is rarely aware when they're activated by an evocative cue.
And since he's not aware of the association, how what happened to him affects his relationships, he may have a whole history of uncomfortable or sabotage relationships with the male figures in his life. They may be coaches or teachers or other men who could be positive role models for him, but he unconsciously avoids or rejects the opportunities.
Exactly. It's like when you weren't aware of why you were afraid to be alone at night. You weren't aware of the associations you'd made earlier in your life. Our behaviors begin to shape themselves around the emotional landmines left by previous trauma. But remember, the brain is always trying to make sense of the world, so this boy will struggle for an explanation. Maybe he decides he doesn't like English, or he starts to think that the teacher doesn't like him, that the teacher is a jerk. The teacher has no idea that any of this is happening. So let's say the student is struggling with a writing assignment. The teacher comes over with the intention of helping. He views his offer of help as a positive thing. As he bends to look at the work, his hand comes to rest on the boy's shoulder. But instead of being calmed, the boy recoils, reacting aggressively before even thinking. The lower brain immediately says, danger, danger, and activates the stress response system, which immediately shuts down the cortex. So there's no chance for a reasoned, rational response. Later on, if you talked to the boy and said, you shouldn't swear at a teacher, he'd say, I know, it's not a good idea. But in the moment, he truly didn't have access to that ability to reason. The more you learn about trauma and stress response, the easier it is to understand certain behaviors you encounter in a workplace, in a relationship, or at school.
His brain, triggered by his past association with violence, sends a signal of threat, and he responds with fight or flight. Get your hands off me.
Maybe even get your effing hands off me. This aggressive, impulsive lashing out is completely baffling to the teacher. He doesn't understand what is really going on. When he describes the scene to others, he'll say something like, for no reason at all, he just came at me. This is one of the most common descriptions of the behavioral outbursts related to evocative cues. Out of the blue. Unpredictable. The behaviors seem unprovoked.
I just had another aha. So often we use the word snapped when we don't know where a burst of anger is coming from or why someone is having a violent reaction. Well, now we know something has happened in that moment that triggers one of the brain's trauma memories. And because the lower non-rational parts of the brain are its first responders, they immediately set off stress responses that then shut off the reasonable part of the brain. And so that burst of violence is actually the result of some highly organized processes in the brain. And in this case, the first thing the school is going to say is, what's wrong with him? The teacher, now convinced that something is wrong with that child, reports him to the principal's office, when what he should be asking is, what happened to this child?
That's right. This child will be viewed as a problem child. And if it continues, he will be sent to see the school counselor, then suspended, then referred to a mental health provider. And if no one in the mental health system understands his behavioral issues are related to what happened to him, related to his trauma, then they will also make a whole set of well-intended but ineffective interventions. If, on the other hand, this school had the resources and tools to help its teachers understand the prevalence of childhood adversities and the impact of trauma on learning, plus strategies to help create a regulated, safe, and secure classroom, the behavior would have been viewed quite differently. Rather than suspending and labeling the child, the school would try to create a process to connect with and understand him.
But that only starts if you ask the question, I wonder what happened to that child.
Exactly. If you change how you try to understand behaviors. The good news is that when schools do learn about the effects of trauma and make some simple changes in how they evaluate, support, and teach, they see dramatic improvements in academic achievement and decreases in challenging and disruptive behaviors. If the classroom uses regulatory strategies, the teachers are supported and respected, the needs and strengths of the children are identified and addressed, the outcomes are much better. We work with schools all over the world using our neurosequential model in education, NME, which teaches many of the core concepts you and I have been discussing. NME provides examples of classroom strategies to implement these principles and concepts. The results are very promising. Teachers, administrators, parents, and children all report positive effects, and the outcomes support these views. Many other groups are introducing trauma-informed programs into schools as well. As with the definition of trauma-informed care, the elements of these different models and programs vary tremendously. But all of the successful models have one thing in common. They emphasize regulation and connection.
So helping children regulate is a key what to do in a trauma-aware school. Regulate, relate, then reason. Yes? Appreciating the sequence of engagement is essential.
Yes. Unfortunately, our schools are typically not trauma-aware and tend to prohibit many of the regulatory activities we've mentioned. Walking, rocking, fiddling with things while listening to a lesson, listening to music with your earbuds while you're doing homework. Somatosensory regulation, such as the rhythmic activities we have discussed, actually opens up the cortex and makes the reasoning parts of the brain more accessible for learning. Schools also tend to minimize powerful healing and resilience-building activities like sports, music, and art. These are often viewed as elective or enrichment activities, when in fact, they can be the very bedrock of academic learning, thanks to their regulatory and relational elements. Pattern, repetitive, rhythmic activity makes the overactive and overly reactive core regulatory networks get back in balance. Music falls into this category, both playing and listening. All sports involve doses of it, dance too, and of course, each of these activities also has very important relational elements. You learn when you pass the ball to your teammate. You learn how to move with your dance partner. You synchronize playing your violin with other members of the orchestra. Finally, there are cognitive elements to sports, music, and other arts. They engage, activate, and synchronize activity throughout the brain, from the bottom up and from the top down. These are whole brain, healthy activities. Now imagine 30 children sitting in rows in a classroom, passively listening to a teacher lecture. This is not an efficient way to engage the top part of the brain. We learn faster when we're moving and interacting with others. We store new information and retrieve previously stored information most efficiently when engaged in some form of somatosensory activation during learning.
After the student blows up and the school sends him to a mental health service,